Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the September 26th, 2023 edition of Ask a Leader. Welcome back, Anteaters. Now you've discovered there's radio on your campus, and you can discover there's training on your radio station on your campus. So go to the KUCI.org website and get all the particulars from the @training.KUCI.org trainer here and get yourself a show, like a public affairs show or a music show. Now for our programming today. My guests are in two parts in advance of her October 20 workshop at UCI for PhD students is Kimberly Duong, UCI School of Engineering graduate, now employed as a water agency civil engineer. She's returning to the show to talk about her new calling as a PhD coach, assisting students in productivity, project management, procrastination, and anything else related. And I do have I have some of those questions to follow up on there. In the second segment, Brianna Walker, at Minnie Van Hill, as she's known on Twitter, returns in her capacity as a local muckraker to talk about local school board culture wars policies cropping up all over Orange County. Her work is proof of the importance of down ballot voting, such as the next primary, March 5th, 2024. We'll be right back. Thank you, everybody, for staying tuned. Welcome back to the show. My first guest is Dr. Kimberly Duong, one of the last guests I had in studio in the before times. She just completed defending her PhD dissertation in civil engineering with climate change on her mind, bringing along an undergraduate who helped her build climate memes on Climatepedia at UC Irvine. Now Kimberly, a seasoned water management agency professional, is bringing along PhD students as they negotiate the process of completing their PhD programs. And you notice the public service, the self-serving element here? Okay, I did. She wants to share lessons learned and help others succeed in their own PhD journey. Kimberly employs a tailored one-on-one approach, drawing on more than 10 years of project management, leadership, STEM outreach, and mentorship experience in academia, government, nonprofits, and entrepreneurship. And that's where I first met her, was when she was on the show, on the road with a particular flair, and I'm just hoping that comes through today. Her diverse background includes wetlands, fieldwork in Melbourne, Australia, to science policy at the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine in Washington, D.C. She joins me in studio. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, Kimberly Duong.
Hi, Claudia. It's so good to see you again.
It is so good, folks. You don't know sometimes, but I can't restrain myself, and I'm all fangirled about what Kimberly does and how she does it. First, though, it's the obvious question, but how did your PhD path proceed? I'm guessing there wasn't a Kimberly Duong kind of pro on your team at that time.
Yeah, when I graduated, it was a little less clear what I could do with my degree other than academia. I think these days there's a little bit more transparency around careers outside of academia for PhD students. But when I graduated years ago, it was pretty much become a professor, become a postdoc, or you could work for the government and do research there. So I was really trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I'd worked in a nonprofit. I did a fellowship in Washington, D.C., trying to figure out if that's what I wanted to do after I graduated. And so it's taken a while, but I feel pretty good now about what I'm doing. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that, the coaching.
Well, and you know, what comes to my mind is that there is this kind of default about staying in the research areas and academia, yeah, and thank you, Sherwin-Roland, for letting people know. He persisted in leaving the bench, and he went worldwide with the ozone depletion research that he did. He became a very public figure, and it took years for people to recognize what he's doing. So I want to think of Sherwin-Roland as sort of, it's on his shoulders that you're sort of looking at. There's some very public other kinds of careers where the PhDs can take that. So that's the beginning of that. So you're becoming a coach. Were you informally helping other people? And you thought, wait a minute, this is a shingle that's got to be hung officially.
Yeah, actually, it wasn't until I was helping some fellow students when I was a late stage student. And they were telling me things like, oh, you're really good at this. You know, have you thought about helping other students? And I talked to someone once who I had barely known. We'd met during some workshop. And while I was asking some questions about their PhD, they actually started tearing up. And they were saying, like, I've never really talked about this with other people. And I just thank you so much for this conversation. And I was thinking, well, I'm just here, you know, trying to help them and trying to figure out what they're all about, because the last workshop that we did was about, oh, what do you want to do in your career? And I think that's kind of the place where students stop and think, wait, what am I doing with my career? I'm here doing this program for years, but what's after this? I don't know, actually. And I don't know if the typical path of postdocs and researchers and professors is really my path. And I think some people kind of get lost in that purgatory of not knowing, if I don't follow the path, what path do I follow?
Because there are sort of currents that you got to swim against the current, you got to swim out of it.
Yeah.
Like, and then find, okay, this other current is something. And I want to find out if, let's say, the urgency, I call it, so I think climate catastrophe more than climate change kind of
right.
summons the conditions we are in. So with the urgency of those trends, is that something that sort of helps you support and validate for them that, well, maybe there's some more immediate things to do in a career than the being on the bench?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the earlier that you start thinking about it, the better. Because when
Good point.
When you're in, I mean, I talked to someone who was in their second postdoc. So you can imagine this is after 4 years of undergraduate.
Second? No,
yeah.
No.
6 years of PhD, 3 years in a postdoc, and then 2 more years in a second postdoc. They're a year away from not being employed anymore. And then they think, well, actually, do I want to keep doing this? I don't know. And at that point, like, what do? Do you start over? You just throw it all away? Do you pivot? I think that's a really hard time to try to figure out what the next step is. So if you can start thinking about this early on, you know, when you start your PhD program, when you're in the middle, even towards the end, it's much better of a time than when you're already in this mode of success that other people have defined for you and you don't feel like you're succeeding for yourself. I think that's the hard part.
Wow. For those of you who've just joined us, my guest is Kimberly Duong in studio. Yahoo! She's UCI School of Engineering PhD graduate, now employed as a water agency civil engineer, talking about her PhD coaching service. So you've got maybe some models you're using and honing the skill. How did all of this come together and you figured out how to do the one-on-one sorts of custom designed coaching approach?
Yeah, I personally have always enjoyed one-on-one conversations more so than a lecture style or a classroom style. I have taught in that capacity before, but I think with the PhDs specifically, there's just so much nuance for every person's degree. I mean, even within the same department, people could be doing completely different types of research, coming from completely different countries and backgrounds, and the paths that they can take in their career are also very different. So the one-on-one conversations are really there to be specific and tailored to this person's past and their future. So I really enjoy that because it's a way to get to the root of what they're talking about. There's so many other distractions that we can talk about, and I think those are hard to get off the surface if you're not talking in this one-to-one capacity.
Do you want to talk about those distractions?
Sure.
Go for it.
I think one of them is this idea of success in the academic sense, where you're chasing accolades like fellowships, grants. That's great if you want to pursue that line of work in the future. If you want to become a postdoc and then a professor, then applying for lots of grants and getting fellowships is great. But if you decide that, actually, I want a life of entrepreneurship, or I want to start my own coffee business, I don't know if getting academic grants and fellowships is really setting you up for success there. It's more training you for a very specific type of skill that you may not use if you're not planning to go into that type of career. So I consider that as a potential distraction if you have already identified, I don't want to continue in academia for the rest of my life. Then it is a distraction because it's considered success in the here and now, and it's irrelevant in the future.
And we are reminded, spend enough time in the university culture, and we're reminded of those kinds of distractions. So I'm curious, when did you actually start the coaching? Legit,
so
shingle hanging.
I was coaching my fellow students, I think as early as 2018, and meeting informally with them, just friends. But I started taking on clients last year, and that's where I kind of formalized all the processes that I have. Mm-hmm. And I have been working with a few students. I have a student who I've been working with for over a year, actually. And I, when I met with them, they kept saying, I wish I started working with you 3-4 years ago. And it just made me think, like, why have I waited so long to start doing this?
So, and let's go over your clientele. Could you be starting with some that are finishing their undergraduate programs?
Absolutely, yeah.
There's
a wide range. Yeah, ideally they would start with me early on, but a lot of the people that come to me are in their last year of the PhD. That's kind of where they have that moment of, wait, what am I doing after this? You know, they kind of get through all of those hurdles of passing the exams and finishing their courses and getting all of their research papers published. And now they're at the point where, after I graduate, I need to find a job. I need to do something else. I need to figure out what I'm doing with my life now that all the schooling is, 20 plus years of schooling is over.
And on your website, and we'll include that in the podcast summary, it's coachkimberly.com, that you break it down and, how does this differ from actually your research team? And so maybe somebody gets on early enough, your coaching repertoire would include helping them put their committee together for their PhD program.
Possibly. I do tell the students I work with that my work is not a replacement or substitute for research advisors. And that is because I can't be the expert in whatever you're working on, even if we're coming from the same department.
Or know the politics of that department.
Of course,
because that's
going to
be a huge dynamic
there. And I think people mistake advising with coaching, because advising is I'm giving you advice. I'm telling you what you should do. Coaching is more like I'm asking you the questions and you are figuring out the answers.
Okay. So I asked about when you started, and as I'm hopping around here on these topics, is that I didn't know if during COVID, but you probably were informally working during COVID, but we can't say that it changed your coaching at that point, because you really started in earnest you said like a year and a half ago. So, and the field, you were saying that you're not taking the place of the research advisor.
Yep.
So, but are you finding it's not just engineering coachees that you're taking on? You're taking them all from all over any kind of an academic situation?
Yeah, most students that come to me are from STEM backgrounds.
Okay, makes sense.
It is important for them to have a coach who has a STEM background as well, just culturally speaking. Understanding what the expectations are and what the programs are like.
Okay. And so we're going to make sure you talk about, what I wanted to find out. It's a little bit out from left field, but have you identified some kind of Me Too issues with a client? Because maybe a committee is part of the issue with a student that's trying to ward off any kind of harassment going on. But and in STEM, it's a different level of competition, and there's different power imbalances going on in STEM. So I don't know if you're looking at some of those for your clients, and you're sort of helping them recognize what's going on and push back, to negotiate that and get through it. But that's not come up yet, or maybe that's going to be part of your new shingle.
That hasn't been an issue for me personally with the clients that I've worked with, but I have heard of issues like this before. I will say that the majority of students I work with are female, and one of the reoccurring issues is this feeling that they have to be either following what the convention is, and the communication style is a little different. And so I work with them on, for example, managing up with advisors, being more assertive in their language, and basically changing the way that they communicate so that they can be more effective. And for them, being more effective might look like, oh, I should just do everything my advisor says and not ask any questions because I don't want to look stupid. And to me, I'm trying to get them to think more like, we need to make sure that you are getting everything that you need to be effective in your role. And if that means that you feel a little bit embarrassed while asking questions, so be it, because that's what we need to do to improve this situation. If you're feeling stressed and you don't know what you're doing, then we need to make that clear so that you can get the help that you need. And sometimes they don't have the words, they don't have the language, they don't have the comfort in speaking up and saying what they need and asking for what they need.
So you're a perspective coach here, right? And so I'm wondering, there probably is a light bulb that goes off and they say, wow, this is all, these are life skills. And I'm not gonna do the life coach line, but there's life skills they're getting in negotiating that PhD program.
Yes, absolutely. I have a student I'm working with now whose number one issue was procrastination.
Okay, that's one of the several things you're talking about.
I'm sure there's lots of other people who can understand that being a major issue. So we spent a lot of time talking about what their relationship with procrastination is. And since that conversation, it's like night and day. They have completely changed their perspective on procrastination. Some weeks they work 5 times more than they thought they would. They are jumping on tasks when they used to avoid the tasks. And that's something I call reverse procrastination. We can talk about that if you'd like.
Yes, please.
So there's a strategy that I like to use for students who have identified a very specific task that they've been procrastinating on forever. And I'll give you an example. I had a student who was graduating very soon, was already looking for jobs, but their LinkedIn profile was blank. It was a picture from like 6 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. And there's nothing in there. And I said, do you want to update your LinkedIn? And they said, oh yeah, for sure. Weeks go by. They haven't updated. Every week they got an excuse. Oh, I mean, I just need to get, you know, I need to get like a better picture. I need to get someone to take it for me. I don't know exactly what words to use. And so after several weeks, I said, okay, we need to talk about this. What's behind the hesitance on the LinkedIn profile? And all the other excuses out of the way, they said, I'm afraid to be judged on social media. That's the
root
issue.
LinkedIn is social media.
Yes, it is. And so they were afraid to put even one word on their profile. And so I said, okay, well, let's redefine what this is, because it's not a social media profile for you. It is a way for recruiters or hiring managers to see what your experience is. And that's not any different than a resume with a picture on top. And so they said, okay, I can do that. I'm not going to go into the making posts every day and updating this and that, but I'll make a mirror of my resume. And I said, okay, let's talk about that. And even something as minor as editing the title, you know, graduate student researcher maybe, and the department that they're in, they couldn't even do that. So I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to break down this task, this one task, into steps that are so stupidly simple that you're going to feel like, oh, of course, I can do this. So the tasks are individually as short as 1 second. First thing, open laptop. Okay, I can do that. Type linkedin.com. I can do that. That's easy. Click on experience section. That takes 1 second. Type graduate student researcher. Okay, click save. So we break down one task into steps that are so easy that they're not scary anymore. There's no failing at them. You can't fail at opening a laptop. You've done it millions of times. And so I'm breaking down this scary big thing into something that feels like it's manageable, bite-sized pieces. And what happened was, you know, this client wrote down all the steps, and, you know, there's 30 of them to update a LinkedIn profile to this degree of granularity. And one day they just decided on the weekend, screw it, I'm just going to do it. Finished the entire thing in an hour, filled out everything, all the details, new picture, everything looked beautiful. And it took them years to do something that actually took half an hour, but they got it done.
There you go, reducing the tasks so that it's simpler. It's the barriers no longer interfere with the execution.
Yeah, it's like that phrase, how do you eat an elephant?
I was thinking of that, one bite at a time.
That's right.
Just keep biting. So the coaching that you do, fast forwarding here, is that you're also helping them with transitioning employment. You're doing that and helping them set up their LinkedIn profiles and filling it all the way in. But they can see that that's coming.
Right. That's one aspect of it.
And so do you want to just tell us a little bit about how people can join you? It's the October 20th at UCI. It's an online forum from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific time, because you're going to get people from all over the world on this one, is my guess.
It's a virtual workshop. It's through UCI GPS STEM. It's a professional development organization for STEM students, but this event is available for all PhD students and postdocs. I'll send you the link so that you can include it. People can RSVP. It's open now if you want to RSVP. And yeah, I'll be giving a workshop about project management tools and how to combat procrastination.
Very, very good. A really great tool. So do you want to let listeners know how they can follow you? And I mentioned it's coachkimberly.com is the whole website for your entire enterprise here still working at the water agency.
Yes. So if students want to reach me, talk to me one-on-one, you can find me there. You can schedule a free consultation. I'm also happy to take emails. You can reach me on there as well. And that's the best way to find me.
Well, this is very good. I'm so glad to see you again, Kimberly. Thank you for taking the time. It's very instructive. There's more to say. We've got a very ambitious program today, and it was a very, very excellent start to that. Thank you so much for being on Ask a Leader today.
Thanks, Claudia.
My guest was Kimberly Duong. She was a PhD student, and she completed her graduate degree now. She's at a water agency as a civil engineer, hanging her shingle as a PhD coach in advance of the October 20th workshop at UCI. We'll be right back with Brianna Walker about the parent rights notification policy throughout Orange County. Don't go away. Welcome back to the show. My next guest is Brianna Walker, a.k.a. In Mini Van Hell, taking up the fraught politicking on the local school district level, particularly the parent rights notification policy. Put in another way, listener's guide on behind the scenes of the dismantling of public education in Orange County. In a zero sum of time and finances, the kids are not all right. Precious resources are being squandered to advance culture wars that interfere with the education process in its entirety. It's important to cover this to make very clear the opportunity costs at our kiddos' expense. Brianna is a stay-at-home mother to 5 children in Orange County Public Schools. She claims that she began in local politics during COVID using Twitter. Yes, that social media trademark I will continue to use. She's using Twitter as a platform under the handle of In Mini Van Hell, but I maintain she's been probably synthesizing goings on, current events for a much longer time than the COVID period. She's taken some lumps for connecting dots that have held quite a few people accountable for connecting dots for public consideration. She joins me in studio as well today. Welcome back to Ask a Leader, Brianna Walker.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
The last time she was on, she wasn't in studio, but she was on a Ask a Voter show in the primary of the previous, the midterm election cycle. Well, let's start. I want to sort of map that we're going to start around the 20-foot level, and then we're going to go up 60,000 feet, because this is a broad-reaching sort of there's an end game that's really mapped out, and maybe we'll get back down the 20 feet. And if we need more time, we're going to extend this interview in a recording after the broadcast, and you can listen to everything on the askaleader.com. Then I'm going to archive all the show in. So we've got Chino Valley Unified in San Bernardino County, mm-hmm. and Capistrano Valley is in the works, but we're going to focus mostly on what's in play in Orange Unified School Districts, the constituencies that are consuming the public education, the public libraries, they're all involved. So let's talk about the policy that is, it's a sort of a shifting document in the Orange Unified School District, and in the where there is a majority of, we'll say, a conservative ideology that is trying to gradually, and it's in a very intricate and arcane way, gradually sort of dial up how much of the curriculum, the supplies, the whole the kind of negotiation of the campus kind of identities and all that are worked out. So let's start with the parental, we're going to use the parental notification rule as the kind of model of what is going on with the school districts, and especially in Orange Unified. It's like a trial balloon for other districts.
Yeah, so I do think that it needs to back up just a tiny bit to Chino Valley for a second. There was a policy. It was, I believe, written by Cal Policy Center by one of their attorneys, and Chino Valley was the first to pass it. So it was a generic policy that had been posted online. One of their trustees, I believe the president, Sonia Shaw, brought it forward, and that was passed. Once that was passed, it was passed by a few other school districts, and eventually it made its way to Orange Unified. Orange Unified held a board meeting where they did a first reading on the policy and held discussion. After the first reading, they had at the next board meeting a secondary reading.
This has all happened in the beginning of September.
First reading may have been August.
Okay.
And then the second reading, where they were going to pass it or not pass it, would have been in September. Between the first reading and the second reading, they published their agenda with a copy of the notification. And that notification was significantly different than the policy that was passed in Chino. And it was what most people in the area described as being more compassionate, if that's possible. So it did show a little bit more compassion. It allowed psychologists to be more involved, and not just administrators. It allowed children to be able to say no, that they didn't want parents to be notified.
Well, let's say what that rule is. We have to say what's in the rule.
I mean, to be honest with you, I don't even have copies of the rules now, because it has been changed so many times, and the new rule has not been.
That's the central theme.
Published.
Okay.
So this temporary agenda item showed that there was, allowed professionals to be involved, and it was what a lot of people felt like was going to be the best case scenario to be passed by a far right extremist school board. So a lot of people, staff, students, families, community members, did not show up to the meeting because they knew that no matter what, this policy was going to get passed. And this to them was significantly less discriminatory than the previous one. So it was a little bit more compassion, something that they were able to, they didn't necessarily want to show up in a environment that was going to be created to create fear, right? So outside agitators were coming in. They knew this. They have been traveling around to school boards.
And outside, let's say it's not outside the district. It could be even outside of the region.
Most of them are, yes.
And some of them are coming from around the country.
Yes.
Because we're going to talk, we'll mention, if not here in the continuation in a later recording, right, we're going to talk about how there's a parent picnic today in CME. And when you read the roster of the speakers, they're coming from all over the country. So it's a real astroturfing proposition coming into Orange Unified's chambers.
Absolutely. And they're bringing in some extremists with ties to Proud Boys, Gays Against Groomers. So these are to terrorize the community. So a lot of community members, staff members, they did not go to the meeting because they did not want to put themselves in a situation where they would fear for themselves. On a agenda item that had been watered down some. And so at 3 o'clock, when the meeting was about getting close, ready to begin, they handed out a new copy of the policy, and it was completely different than what was agendized. That policy was significantly worse, if possible, than Chino Valley, to the extent that they are now notifying parents if a child over the age of 12 holds a private conversation with their counselor and shares that they are considering or they are struggling with their gender identity, and they are asking for help, seeking help, wanting to talk to a counselor in private, in a private session. Now that is being reported.
So I want to pause for everybody to think now. What that means is that we have adolescents whose job it is to struggle with identities of every flavor. So in a way, it's sort of like capturing everybody's potential. Everybody's sort of self-discovery is now becoming pathologized in a public policy to say, we're going to broadcast your, you know, internal struggle with a parent that parent, and I don't know how far beyond there, that would likely, could potentially have some kind of a very intricate, fraught dynamic at the home setting.
Oh, absolutely. So you are bringing the school into a private situation. We don't know what's happening in the home. We don't know the discussions already happening in the home. This is based off of an idea. That would be like you and I going to a counselor and speaking, I'm married. How about if I talk to a counselor in private and say that I'm having concerns with my husband, and they pick up the phone and call my husband? I mean, these are private, confidential conversations, and children have the right to privacy. They also deserve some form of privacy. So this is not children that are socially transitioning. These are kids with
being kids.
And so that is being reported to their parents on an arbitrary timeline. Some of it's two days, 3 days, up to 5 days. None of this is based off of any type of professional mental health professionals' opinion. These are politicians deciding when they feel it's appropriate. So a counselor has to notify within only a certain amount of days a parent, or they have to write down and publish it to the school district why they decided not to report it to the parent. The policy passed by Orange Unified is frightening. It is incredibly scary to think of the damage that's being done between the safe space of a school and a student, and also the damage between a child and a counselor. How do you mend a relationship that many of us as adults still see therapy? I mean, therapy is amazing.
Yeah, yes.
How do we, I find there are no positives to these policies, that we are pushing policies that ultimately leave with just damaged relationships that can be lifelong between a child and their parents, between a child and the school, which they typically find as a safe space, between them and administrators, and them with their counselors. We are damaging these relationships.
In preparation for this interview, Brianna, you mentioned that there is a choice, and I'm not sure how you can document this, but make sure we're grounding this in what you've discovered, your research, is that at the school site, a student will decide to out their concerns with a bully versus bringing that to a home discussion. And there was a calculus that you talked about, and that's sort of it's a bizarre sort, it's antithetical to what people would think and how you would deal with your adolescent concerns.
Yeah. So every situation is going to be different. We don't know the dynamics in everyone's home. But as a parent, I think about students that don't feel comfortable coming out to their families. And in some circumstances, when they are willing to be socially transitioned, so they want to be identified as a different gender or no gender or a different name, they are willing to do that with their classmates, their peers, which includes kids that are not going to be accepting. And as we all know, kids can be mean and there are bullies. So these are students that are willing to transition in front of bullies, but aren't comfortable at this point talking to their parents. And that to me is a red flag. And I'm not necessarily saying that there is something wrong with a parent or at their home, but there is something that the child feels uncomfortable with. And I believe, as a parent myself, I'm their village, right? I know
home
these
office
kids.
And village.
I've been their team moms. I've been their room moms. I have been on the PTA. I have volunteered with these children. So these children who are now struggling, as a community member, we know these kids. The outside agitators coming in and who refer to them as derogatory terms and it's and them's, we know them. They're our community and we are their village. So we know that we're trusting them. If they don't want to share this right now and they're willing to share it with their peers or maybe not, just with their counselor, then we trust them. We are their support network and this is how we show them love. Because at the end of the day, as parents, we are raising adults, not children. I'm raising my children currently to become adults. And we need to allow them the right to navigate themselves through their lives.
And have agency and understand what privacy is and how to protect and manage it.
Exactly.
So for those of you who've just joined us, in studio with me is my guest Brianna Walker, also known as In Mini Van Hill, taking up the fraught politicking around school boards in Orange County. And I think people are noticing or should be wondering, maybe, is this a policy in search of a problem?
Absolutely. This is creating a problem. And ultimately, in my opinion, it is creating a problem with the goal to destroy public schools. And we're seeing that firsthand at these schools that are being targeted. For instance, in Orange Unified, over 25% of their top administrators and principals, mostly women of color, have resigned. And they're being replaced by mostly men. So we're seeing a significantly less diverse administration in these school districts. We're seeing positions of certified, so our teachers, we're seeing a large in this school district. So in Chino, in Orange, in the school districts being targeted, we are seeing those positions increase and not be filled. People are not wanting to go and teach in these school districts. So we are seeing not only Chino now being tied into lawsuits and spending their money on public education into lawsuits that they want to hopefully take to the Supreme Court. We're also seeing teachers leave, administration leave. We're seeing the quality of their education decrease. And from that, we're going to see parents searching for other options, right? If you're not getting a good education for your child, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to stick around or are you going to start looking for alternatives?
Well, that's a very complicated problem because the mobility is certainly limited because of the utter expense now of locating into another home somewhere. So that's that. Not everybody can consider that. So let's.
But I think that that's the point, right? I think that we show statistically that charter schools do not help everybody. And who are they? Who are these divisive policies going to be impacting the most?
So when you were talking about Chino District, using funds to litigate and defend their ordinances, their regulations. So that's, I want people to understand, that's why I brought up in the introduction here, it's a zero sum. So I don't know how much time in the recent meetings before, back to the Orange Unified School District, there's time. That's a zero sum. How much time is being spent discussing a policy about how to deal with a with the trans demographic, and more broadly would capture many others? So how much is the discussion before the board? How much is a school budget getting tapped to advance these agendas? Because that's the zero sum, and we haven't even gotten to what kinds of resources, attention, are then not being given to improving the curriculum, which is what the school district exists for.
Right. I don't know if there's a number yet. I do know that law firms have come forward to offer their help to some of these school boards to try, because of course they want to bring this to a Supreme Court level. So I know that the Liberty Justice Institute is involved right now with the Chino Valley lawsuit, and there is a temporary restraining order. They had tried to implement the policy immediately and it was halted. So as of right now, it's been halted. And I believe that the Dillon Law Firm is also attached. The Cal Policy has offered their own services. So there are a lot of far-right law firms that are wanting to get involved. We have heard this
That's
before.
A lot of resources when you bring in all of those.
A lot.
And if there's an asymmetry, the resources that are advancing this agenda versus people that are just trying to get their kids to school, get them to finish their work, and they don't have the resources, the time to track every single development.
Absolutely.
So that's that asymmetry I wanted to bring in there too. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, absolutely. So there is a lot of information we're still going to be having to follow. And there's been some amazing groups that are trying to keep parents informed. Our Schools USA is one of them. And I know that they are trying to keep track of the lawsuits and to keep parent. I think that becomes the issue, is that as parents, we don't even know what's going on. A lot of Chino families don't know. Is it being implemented right now? Same with Orange. Has it? It's passed. Is it being implemented right now? What is going on? We have a lot of kids living in fear right now that don't know if their parents are going to be contacted, because they don't know what's currently happening. They only know that it's been discussed and it's been passed. To understand if something is, if a restraining order is in order, or if it's not been implemented, there is a lack of knowledge to the community. I couldn't tell you right now if Orange has been implemented. I don't believe it has, but again, I'm uncertain on that.
So at the household level, back, that's 20 feet above the ground there, there's a lack of clarity there, but we can, moving back up to maybe 30, 40,000 feet up, Liberty Justice, the Dillon Law Firm, and the California Policy Center, they know exactly where the pin is right now.
Absolutely. They have been, this has been a long game. They've been working on this for a long time.
Well, I noticed that one of the conversations through that platform we've mentioned here is that Sean Steele, husband of Representative Steele, mm-hmm. of the 45th Congressional District, Michelle Steele, that he published an article as a young libertarian or young Republican in 1970. He wanted to end, among other things, he wanted to end compulsory education. So the long game could start somewhere before, during Sean Steele's publication in 1970.
I'm sure. I would hate to give him too much credit, but I do think he has been highly involved in this, and I think that he is.
This was in the LA Times he published it, by the way. So that's not a cryptic kind of platform.
No, yeah. He has been heavily involved, and he has held some talked at a few events up in Northern California within the last year, talking about getting far-right Republicans onto school board leaderships as trustees. And he has been supportive of Cal Policy Center and all of their organizers. He has definitely been a stronghold in the California Republican Party for decades. And I think that he is definitely playing a role on the back end, as well as many other, from Mark Butcher to Will Swam to so many others.
Will Swaim.
Swaim.
With Swaim, yeah.
Is it really worth pronouncing his name correctly?
No, just so people know, because he's Will Swaim, he's been involved
the
in
editor,
so
yeah.
many different platforms here, and I remember him at Vista Verde. And
right.
so,
and they have been the creators of current leadership, like, for instance, Mary Barkey. So they created her, and
who represents this Orange County Board of Education district where we're
in
seated.
In Irvine.
Right here.
Yes.
And Barkey, and that's, again, I mentioned the introduction. This is a reminder. Down ballot is a whole lot going on, folks. And Mary Barkey's only 2 years into her, I don't know if it's her second or third term, but we were redistricted into her district. So she's involved in all of these agendas we're talking about.
Absolutely. She is a part of Cal Policy Center in addition to being on the Orange County Board of Education.
So this whole effort, and I didn't get a chance to show you, Brianna, there was an article, it was yesterday, that was about the Muslim voters are now signing on to this agenda in a sympathetic way of maligning LGBTQ kinds of identities as they are addressed on the, you know, primary, secondary education level. So that this is a wedge, ladies and gentlemen, that is getting, it's not just working at, we're talking about the 20-foot level at the school district, the school campus, but the wedge is sort of peeling off more and more constituencies to join a pretty retro kind of movement.
Yes, I think that I believe the majority of parents support public schools. We support our schools. We love our teachers. We love our schools. We love our principals. We love them. And this has been used as a wedge to separate parents from the school. And who do you have to support the schools if you lose the parents, right? If we are the supporters, we're going to fund you through our PTA and fundraising. We're going to support you in the classroom and volunteer and be your room
it's
parents.
A lot of in-kind work and an outlay of real money.
Right. So
huge.
We are subsidizing what can't be brought in by the state. So what happens when we as parents have been brought, this wedge has been, and the majority of us, because it is the majority, we support schools. We support our teachers. We support our staff. We support our public schools. So what happens when this wedge comes in and starts to separate it? How does that work how does that work for public schools? That's going to destroy them. This smoke and mirror policy is going to just drive this web between parents and teachers. And it's so sad because as of right now, the majority of parents truly support their teachers. We do support them. We do support these public schools. And I do think that organizations like the Cal Policy Center has been very creative on creating this wedge that's very damaging and using disinformation to get groups of parents, all different groups of parents, to believe them.
So tools, I think we're going to get this all in this one broadcast. The tools where parents and staff dealing with the impact of these parental notification policies, the number 866-975-8870, call that number. And then we're going to move on tonight, as I mentioned fleetingly earlier, Simi Valley is going to be the venue for California Policy Center's Food Trucks and Family Picnic. And the representatives are people we've just been talking about, the California Policy Center, Moms for Liberty, Red State, Prager U Kids, among many, many others. So are you going to head up to Simi today?
I am not.
Somebody's going to.
I'm going to be driving carpool with my children.
See, there's the asymmetry. Like, the astroturfing.
I can't make it there. Nobody's paying for me to drive to Simi Valley to hold a rally. But I do want to emphasize one more time that phone number that you gave out is the Rainbow Youth Project and Our Schools USA. They have created a hotline for LGBTQ+ students and staff members impacted by these parental notification policies in California. It's 866-975-8870. You can call or text, and they will help you. If you are concerned, if you have questions, if you are a parent or a student, they have psychologists, they have resources, they will follow up with you. They are there to help you, and I highly recommend you share this information as much as possible. I also recommend you read your agenda items. Whatever school district you're in, when they publish your agenda, read it. You may not have time to go. You may be driving carpool, but read the agenda. See if there is something there. If you can't make it, reach out to your trustees. Give them a comment. Read your agenda. Capistrano Unified is currently up. They are going to be voting on this.
When is that?
I believe it's October 19th. I will confirm.
And people can live stream the meeting if they can't go down there. It's super convenient to live stream them, and you can read the room. You can see who's talking, how they're talking, and how they're received by the various elected board members.
Yes. Capistrano Unified's October 18th. They are also bringing in outside agitators to Tustin Unified on October 9th, and they will be giving public comments. It's not agendized. It is just going to be a large group of outsiders coming in, pushing for this policy to be on the agenda to be voted on for Tustin Unified on October 9th.
Well, we'll continue this interview after this broadcast, then post that recording along with today's show on askaleader.com. So people can follow you on Twitter, the Bird app, I still want to call it, and at In Minivan Hell, so you can track the politicking going on. The school board, she talks a whole lot of other things. Thank you so much all the work you do and for coming in studio with us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. My guest was Brianna Walker, and you can follow her, as I said, In Minivan Hell. That's my wrap. Next week, UCI professor Keramet Ryder returns about the latest in solitary confinement policy in California and possibly beyond. Talk with you next week. Thank you for listening, everyone.
'Tis of an old butcher, I must bring him in. Charges tuppence a pound, yet he thinks it's no sin. Slaps his thumb on the scale, oh, he makes it go down, and he swears it's good weight.
Honesty's all out of fashion. These are the rigs of the time.